This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We aim to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In the news this episode, the UK air passenger duty is increasing, and we look at the fees and taxes that make up an airline ticket price. The Machinists Union and Boeing are opening up contract negotiations. The NTSB isn't happy with the cooperation it's getting from Boeing. American Airlines places a large order for Boeing and Airbus single-aisle planes. Both pilots on an Indonesian airline fell asleep in flight. Law enforcement in Alaska faces some restrictions when observing from aircraft. And a LATAM flight experiences what the airline called a technical event that injured some passengers. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 790 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year. And he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Hello, everyone. Nice to be here. And the nice thing is I didn't have to fly today, so I'm here on time, which is great.
Well, yeah, I don't know if that's great not flying today. I mean, you fly. How many days out of the week do you fly?
Oh, gosh. It varies a lot. But, sometimes five, sometimes less.
All right. Also with us is our main man, Micah.
Hey, great to be here. Looking forward to a good show. And welcome U.S. and Canadian listeners to our first show in daylight savings time of 2024.
Yeah, that's true. Also here is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. He's from the American Helicopter Museum.
Good afternoon, everyone, or morning, depending upon when you're listening to this. Looking forward to a news-packed show.
We do have a lot of news, and to help us with that is Rob Mark. He's a bizjet pilot, he's a journalist, and he's the publisher of Jetwine.com.
Hey, good evening to everybody, and welcome to our audience from the Chicago side.
There we go. All right. Well, we have a lot of news to get to this episode, so let's jump right in. Our first story comes from the Seattle Times, another item from Dominic Gates. Since Boeing is always in the news these days, it's keeping Dominic Gates busy, I guess, with the Seattle Times. And this is, as watershed contract talks with Boeing open, machinists think big. So, Rob, as we know, Boeing and the International Association of Machinists, the IAM, are negotiating a new labor contract. And the union is asking for, well, a number of different things.
Well, we started to talk about this a couple of weeks ago, and as if Boeing doesn't have enough on its plate right now with the other safety and quality issues it's dealing with. It has a workforce issue in Seattle that involves the fact that so many people are leaving the industry or did leave the industry during the pandemic, and it left them just as short of people as the airlines were short of pilots and mechanics. And now, of course, the machinists are saying, hey, you know what, Boeing, we'd really love to help you out with all these quality issues you're suffering from. Oh, but you know what? It's time that you covered the employees, and it's time for a nice big raise.
They are asking for a raise. They're asking for an increase of over 40% over the next 3 years. That's at least their opening position. They're asking for some other things, too, the restoration of the pension that they used to have. They're also looking for a commitment from Boeing to build the next new Boeing airplane in Seattle. That's a frequent ask that hasn't come to pass yet. They're asking for more quality inspectors, more union input into quality control, And interestingly, to me anyway, a shift in the corporate culture. They'd like to see one that doesn't alienate employees to the extent that they feel they've been alienated in the past.
Well, I think that they're probably also thinking, are they going to get rid of that board of directors? Because they got us here, and I'm not sure that they're going to be able to get us out. But, again, it's the same old story with labor and management at every goofy big business in the country. The companies ask for deals with labor because they're in a tight spot, say, when the economy goes south or something like that. And then magically, when the company starts doing better, they kind of forget how they got there. And it really doesn't bode well for management this time, because not only are labor slightly ruffled feathers, that didn't come out right. Not only does labor have slightly ruffled feathers, but the FAA is on their back. The NTSB is on their back. So this is going to get very busy for Boeing in the next few months.
And this is a lot of machinists. The IAM District 751 represents more than 32,000 Boeing machinists. So we're talking about a really sizable workforce here. And this is the beginning of a process that will take months as the two sides negotiate. The contract itself expires this December 12th, 2024. It sounds like a lot of time between now and then.
Did you say December 12th?
Did I? I meant to say September 12th. Did I say December?
I couldn't. I thought you may have. Anyway, you're right, September 12th.
Right, September 12th, 2024. And there is a meeting and a strike authorization vote that's scheduled for mid-July. So there is some motivation to kind of get at least some of these issues resolved before then. Typically, in these negotiations, they'll go, and I think Dominic mentions this in his article, that typically both sides will go for the sort of the easy things that they can maybe agree on first and get those things behind them, and then move on to the more difficult and contentious issues as the process goes forward.
Yeah, that's where the yelling and screaming starts.
Yeah.
And this is a second union issue that Boeing has in as many weeks. Last week, we were talking about the test pilot issue, who are starting to negotiate or strike or at least act up against it. So it's another strike for Boeing, and strike in whatever double entendre you want to take it.
We have an item from AvWeb, and this is titled NTSB Chair Not Pleased with Boeing's Cooperation on Door Plug Probe. And the NTSB chair, Jennifer Homendy, has been making some comments, Max, about the response they've been getting from Boeing on some of these issues.
Yeah, this is really kind of interesting. It's rare that you would read a sentence that begins, NTSB chair Jennifer Homendy angrily testified today during a Senate hearing. I mean, that's not a phrase you hear very often. And under the picture, the caption says she was not smiling when she addressed Congress regarding Boeing's quality control issues. She said, in a quote, Boeing has not provided us with the documentation and information that we've requested numerous times over the past few months. And she's referring to the door plug that blew out of the Alaska Boeing 737 back in early January. And apparently there were workers from Spirit AeroSystems who came to Seattle to fix some critical rivet work. And they worked with some Boeing team members to access that particular area. And then after it was done, apparently the Boeing team left out four critical bolts, which caused the door to eventually work free and depart the aircraft. Now, Boeing has said that we don't have the records. We don't have the names of the 25 people. That's Jennifer's comment. She said that they've asked for the names of 25 other people. They have not received the names And Boeing essentially responded, and this is kind of interesting, with respect to documentation, if the door plug removal was undocumented, there would be no documentation to share. And it kind of sounds like the work was undocumented, which is kind of surprising, but would explain why the NTSB has not been getting the information they've been looking for.
It is kind of hard to believe that work of that nature is undocumented. I mean, this industry documents everything in minute detail generally. Another comment I would have is that the NTSB is, as an organization and individually, the people there have, in our experience, always been reasonable people. So, I mean, this is not, in my mind, some kind of unrealistic expectations on the part of the NTSB. I mean, between the people in the NTSB that we've met, the people that have been on this podcast as guests, including at least one chair of the NTSB that we've had on this podcast, you know, these are reasonable people who are really dedicated to doing the right thing in the right way. And so if they have a perception that Boeing is sort of obstructing things, or maybe that's too strong a word, is not being as cooperative as they would like to see, I, for one, completely believe them. And this doesn't make Boeing look very good.
Well, let's look at it another way for a minute, Max. You know, if you were at back at Pratt and they're opening up an engine cover for some reason to do any kind of work, there would be documentation that the engine cover was opened. I'm assuming it would absolutely be there because this is a critical safety issue that we're talking about. There's no way that this just does not look good for Boeing. And I'm going to speculate here, which is a dangerous thing as always, but it talks about later on in the article that there's a DOJ criminal investigation that we'll probably talk about later. But if that's going on, then Boeing needs to be tight-lipped. They can't be talking about any of these things to the NTSB because that can be held against them in court. So the lawyers are probably saying, don't provide anything. Say whatever you need to say, but don't provide anything. You can't be held accountable for it unless you're brought to court.
Well, if that was the case, and I would at least hope that Boeing would communicate that to the NTSB, you know, and say that, look, you know, our legal counsel has advised us, you know, this or that or something else, and not just be silent on it. But, so I don't know. And we don't know if there's been any conversations of that sort going on, either between the, you know, the legal counsel for Boeing or between Boeing and the NTSB. Some good news, I think. This will be good news from American Airlines. This comes from the Washington Post. American Airlines to buy 260 planes from Boeing, Airbus, and Embraer to meet growing demand. So, Max, this is a fairly sizable order.
Yeah, it definitely got my attention. When I first read it, I misread it. I thought it said they were buying 260 planes from Boeing, which would have been an even bigger deal. But it says they plan to buy 260 new planes from Boeing, Airbus, and Embraer to meet growing demand. And so still, it's a huge order. These kinds of orders, you know, don't come out every year. They probably come out every few years. And of course, the manufacturers, the OEMs, work for years and fight very hard to get as big a share as these orders as they can. This particular package includes 85 Boeing 737 MAX 10 aircraft. And then let's see what else. It's got 85 planes from Airbus, the A321neo. And then from Embraer, they're buying 90 smaller E175 aircraft, the small single aisles that they have. So anyway, it says they currently have a total of 440 planes on order, some of which won't be delivered until the next decade. So this is good news for everybody involved.
Hmm. In addition to the 260 new aircraft, those are firm orders. We take it. There's also options for 193 additional planes. But one thing that struck me on this was on the 85 Boeings, the 737 MAX 10s, which are still not certified. And United Airlines, because of the difficulties with Boeing, has removed the MAX 10s from its plans, at least temporarily, at least for now. So it was kind of interesting that American Airlines has some faith in Boeing and the MAX 10. So this adds a lot of capacity for premium passengers. That's the, I think, what they're trying to fill. And these new orders would add 20% premium passenger capacity by 2026. All right. Besides Boeing being in the news again and again and again, Alaska Airlines is in the news again this week. There's an item in the New York Post. We'll have a link to that as well as all the others in the show notes. If you can stand all the pop-up ads in the New York Post, this is Alaska Airlines flight carrying pets arrives with cargo door open as carrier and Boeing face $1 billion lawsuit. So Rob, that an open cargo door, that's not how you want to land an airplane.
No, no, absolutely not. In fact, when I first saw this story, I thought it almost said it had opened in flight, which we don't know for certain, because there are idiot lights all over the cargo bay and on the passenger doors that if there's anything remotely unsealed, the cockpit gets a light. And so I thought this was rather odd because those cargo bays are also normally pressurized and heated, because when they do carry animals, if they weren't, I mean, those little buggers would freeze up there at 38,000 feet. And so I think I tend to agree with the Alaska people that maybe this thing hit in such a way that maybe the door wasn't completely fastened, but when they touched down, it was just enough to let it go, and it popped open, and they didn't lose anything. But still, Boeing just ain't going to get a break, are they? I mean, and why don't we hear about all this kind of thing going on with Airbus? Is it that we don't get their news over here? Somehow I'm thinking that if similar problems were occurring in Europe, or of course Airbus is worldwide too, that we would have probably heard, but we don't really hear much about them. Again, doesn't mean it's not happening. I just don't think we have anything to go on with that.
You know, the way that this was reported, here and in other places, in the New York Post and in other places, it talks about, you know, the cargo door was open, which that gave me a visual in my mind of a cargo door open, fully open. But when you look at the photos in some of these articles, I wouldn't call that open. I would call that, I don't know, unlatched or something. I mean, it was open maybe like a couple of inches. It was not the whole thing was open. Maybe it's not quite as bad. Of course, as you say, Rob, I mean, if it's a pressurized compartment, open is open. It doesn't, if it's not closed, it's open. But still, I think it just doesn't seem like it's something that they were flying around with while it was open. Alaska Airlines issued a statement. They said our maintenance teams inspected the aircraft, replaced a spring in the door, tested the door, and re-entered it into service.
If it was a pressurized compartment and it was unlatched, wouldn't it be possible that in flight, the pressurization itself would keep it closed so that it would not come open until it touched down when the pressure was equal on both sides of it?
I think it might, because, of course, doors in the cabin are plugs. I mean, that they're kept in place by the pressurization of the cabin. But these doors slide up and down. It actually, I'm not sure about that.
If you look at the picture, it looks like it opens to the inside, is what the picture shows. So
yeah, you might be right on that.
I don't know enough, but it's just a question that maybe, it wasn't quite latched. Pressurization kept it closed. There were no indications in the cockpit until it came down.
And they only lost four cats. I mean, but
no pets were harmed in this little incident. All right. Moving on to, it starts in the UK. This is from onemileatatime.com. UK air passenger duty increasing, premium cabins hit hardest. how, if you're not aware, the passenger tax in the UK, or a passenger tax in the UK, is called the air passenger duty, or APD. And 1 mile at a time calls it, quote, the highest passenger tax on air travel anywhere in the world. So, Micah, the tax is going up.
Yeah, I noticed this article. Actually, it was Brian that sent it to me, and it looked like it was an interesting discussion topic. The air passenger duty through London Heathrow is going up on domestic economy routes by half a pound, on the premium domestic economy routes by a pound, in long-haul economy going up by 4 pounds, long-haul premium 9 pounds, long-haul economy is only going up by a pound, and long-haul premium is going up by 2 pounds. But what I found interesting about this article is that people don't often realize what the cost of the airline fare is compared to all the taxes and fees and add-ons. And that you might see a fare that when you look at a ticket, you might see the fare is only $20, $30, $40, $100, and $300 and $400 worth of taxes and fees adding on to it no matter where you're going. London, LHR, happens to be just a very expensive place to fly in and out of in general, including a fee that LHR charges if you're dropping off passengers, not even parking the car, just dropping them off. There's a fee for that. But when you look at tickets, and Max, you did some research on this, ticket fees are incredibly high.
They can really add up. And there are several components to the price of an airline ticket that you purchase. There's the base fare, okay? That's the fare that the airline basically sets. It's supposed to cover the actual flight service. But it varies based on a number of different factors, the route, the class, demand. I mean, the airline sets those, can do whatever they like. That's the base fare. But there are also carrier-imposed surcharges. These are additional fees that the airlines add on, and they can include things like fuel surcharges or booking fees or other operational costs. And then we come to the government taxes and fees. And here, it's in the United States anywhere, there are an awful lot of these things. There's an excise tax, and that's a 7.5% tax that is imposed by the government, the U.S. government, on domestic flights. But there's also a flight segment tax. That's $4 per flight segment. That's collected for the FAA. There can be a passenger facility charge, and that's a fee that the airport can charge, maybe up to $18. And the airport that you depart from sets that charge. Then there's more. There's the September 11th security fee. So when you purchase an airline ticket, you pay a $5.60 fee per one-way trip, and that's to offset security costs. Now, we talked about the APD, the air passenger duty in the UK. That's for flights departing from the UK. And that varies, as Micah mentioned. And depending on the fare type, that can range from $16.50 to over $200 for the ticket. And then finally, other countries can have country-specific charges. Most countries have some kind of charge that they apply as well. So when you add all these things up, like you say, Micah, they can represent a significant portion of the total cost of the ticket. I was originally hopeful to be able to say something like, geez, they can add up to be, you know, X percent or, you know, Y percent. But these things are so variable depending on the conditions that, you know, they're going to range all over the map. But there is an example that's given, which is, this is a one-way business class ticket from Seattle to London on British Airways. So the base fare there is 6,001, or at least in this analysis that I found, was $6,189, right? This is business class again. The carrier-imposed surcharges run $955 of that. taxes and fees, including the U.S. security fee, German taxes, the U.K. passenger service charge, all that adds up to more than $600. So you can see in that example that, you know, there's a lot of that airline ticket price that the, you know, is beyond just the base fare.
Why would there be German taxes on that?
That's a really good question, because this is supposed to be a flight from Seattle to London. So I'm really not sure where that one came from.
I think it was on Lufthansa, but I'm not 100% sure.
No, I thought you said it was British Airways.
Oh, was it British Air?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Okay.
So the example might be a little bit twisted, but it kind of makes the point.
What Brian had pointed out to me is that when you're using points, as he often does, some airlines will pay for everything, and all the carrier-imposed fees are included when you buy the fare and the points. Other airlines will sell you the points or let you use the points for the fare, but you're still paying all the carrier-imposed fees. You're always paying the taxes and the other fees, but you'll have to pay the carrier fees as well. So he said that when you're choosing a frequent flyer program to join, you need to see what frequent flyer program is going to offer you the best deal that way.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, another item. This is from the Washington Post. A plane was flying with 159 aboard. Then both pilots fell asleep. Max, that's not supposed to happen.
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing. I think most of us figure, nah, that almost never happens. And I think we recall that the last famous case here in the U.S. was a couple of pilots who were headed to Minneapolis, and they went past Minneapolis by a good 30 minutes before they woke up, and their explanation was that they were so busy on their laptops up there working on their schedules that they just didn't notice that they had flown past their destination. Now, most people felt that that was an unlikely explanation. Yeah. And this article happens to be about a flight that was investigated in Indonesia. And I'll tell you in a moment why it caught my attention. But two pilots of an aircraft carrying 157 people fell asleep mid-flight. This was on Batik Air Flight back on January 25th. The Indonesian NTSB did an investigation and concluded that they were asleep for about 28 minutes. That is, both of them were asleep simultaneously. They didn't identify the pilots other than to say that they were 28 and 32-year-old respectively, which is kind of interesting. It's pretty young crew. We'd probably on average see older captains here in the U.S. And then they give some more details about it. But the thing that really caught my attention was at the bottom. And it said, a survey conducted in July among 6,893 pilots in Europe by an aviation safety consultancy for the European Cockpit Association found that 3 out of 4 pilots fell asleep while flying a plane in the month before the survey.
Whoa.
Perhaps what it doesn't explain is that some of them were allowed to take a nap. Big difference between the U.S. and Europe. Here in the U.S., pilots are not allowed to take a nap in flight, as I understand. In Europe, many airlines actually have a program where one of them is allowed to rest and take a nap. So even though it says 3 out of 4 fell asleep, well, we don't know if they fell asleep accidentally or more likely, you know, they took a nap while their colleague was kind of watching things. You know, I have mixed feelings about pilots being allowed to sleep in flight. On the one hand, it seems to me that it would be a real advantage because pilots often face sleep challenges. But the flip side of that is if one pilot is asleep, man, it's going to be a heck of a lot harder for that other pilot to stay awake. And I think that's the kind of situation they had in Indonesia. One pilot was agreed to go to sleep, but unfortunately the other who was on guard duty fell asleep as well.
See, but that won't be a problem when we only have one pilot on the flight deck anyway, which is what they'd like to go to someday in the future.
They'll all be asleep.
There will be, yeah, they won't be letting that pilot go to sleep.
And this is why I say it's time to do away with daylight savings time.
I'm sure that was the root of the problem in Indonesia.
You know, Captain Nick, who used to fly for Virgin Atlantic and is now retired, he said that within Virgin Atlantic that one pilot was allowed to take a cat nap. And it wasn't a long period of time. I think it was 10 or 20 minutes. And you could do that in the seat as long as it was all worked out. And when you're, you know, flying long haul international, it's a very difficult thing to do. Now, you couldn't do that on takeoff and landing. It's only in cruise, of course, but it was a pretty normal thing to be able to do besides the crew rest time.
Well, this wasn't a particularly long flight either. We see here it's a 2-hour and 35-minute flight. So not exactly a long haul. I mean, that makes me wonder how tired these pilots were, you know, at the start of the flight, if they were already falling asleep in a flight that's that short. But I don't know.
Did they mention whether this was at night?
I didn't see.
It was daylight? Yeah.
I don't think they did.
See that.
But, you know, I think sometimes in the daytime when you've got that sun beaming in, it's just as easy to fall asleep if things are warm, you know, in the daytime as it is to fall at night. But, yeah, I would agree. When you're tired and it's completely dark, pretty easy to fall asleep then too.
Hmm. All right. We have an item from or about Alaska, not the airline, the state, also in the Washington Post. Boy, we have an awful lot of Washington Post stories this week. This is officers need warrants to use aircraft and zoom lenses to surveil areas around homes. This is according to the Alaska Supreme Court. Law enforcement officers cannot use aircraft with binoculars or cameras with zoom lenses to surveil a person's home unless they obtain a warrant.
Yeah. That really struck me as being a potential problem for law enforcement. Years ago, I was lucky enough to do a ride-along with CHP and one of their camera-equipped 206s as they were patrolling above Sacramento, and that was for an article that I was writing. Great fun, very enjoyable to see how that all operates and also to see just how fabulously capable these large cameras are. One thing that really impressed me is they can type an address into the system and the camera automatically zooms in on that particular address. And so they can be, for example, 10 miles away, and they're already, you know, zoomed in right on the spot that they're headed to. And so these zoom cameras have phenomenal lenses, and to restrict law enforcement to say, no, you just got to use your eyes. You can't use these great cameras that we've equipped you with, seems like a rather serious limitation. So this all came about because some troopers were surveilling a property because they'd had a tip that maybe they had some marijuana on the property and they were flying overhead. And in this particular case, the house and its yard was not visible, you know, from outside the fence. So this gave them an opportunity to fly above and peer over the fence, as it were. And essentially the court said, nope, sorry, you can't do that. And there are some limitations to this. There was a phrase, let's see if, here we go. The curtilage of the home. Now, I had not heard of curtilage before, but that refers to those parts of the property that are closely associated with the house itself, such as the front porch, for example. And I think what they said in essence is that you can't surveil the curtilage, but apparently you can surveil, you know, portions that are further out on the property. So it may not be quite as limiting as it initially sounds, but it is fascinating to think of someone who is on patrol having to call on the ground and say, hey, call Judge Thompson. We need a warrant so we can, you know, look at the suspect's house that we're pursuing. It just seems like a huge limitation.
This article made me think of stories that have come out in the past, some years ago, mostly concerning drones and people, either law enforcement or otherwise, using drones to look at people or properties or whatever. And this issue came up a lot, and it seemed to kind of resolve around the fact that local governments had no jurisdiction over the airspace. So that if some town said, no, you can't fly a drone, you know, you can't photograph something or fly it over some kind of event or something that actually the town or the city or the state or whatever didn't have jurisdiction in order to demand that. And so I don't know where this falls because it feels kind of similar. I mean, I don't know if the Alaska Supreme Court is considered to be, you know, a local authority, but it's not the federal authority. And can they say what people can do or not do in aircraft? I'm kind of confused by it.
They can until it's challenged and brought up to the Supreme Court. That's how it works.
And I think that in this case, it's, you know, this is on appeal, and lower courts in Alaska had ruled in, you know, different sides of this thing, and that's why it got to the Alaska Supreme Court. So I think, yeah, Mike, I think you're right that if someone feels that this is not an appropriate ruling, then it would have to be appealed to the Supreme Court, who would then, you know, rule on jurisdiction, I guess. All right. Another item. This is about a LATAM Boeing 787 that was flying to Auckland. And there was some kind of an event on this flight that resulted in about 50 people being hurt or injured in some way or another. Micah, what was this all about?
This happened this morning, actually, this morning Eastern time anyway, where there was a flight flying into Auckland, and passengers reported a violent drop, and I believe 13 people were hurt, were thrown up against the ceiling. They had ambulances meeting the aircraft when it finally landed in Auckland. And Chile, LATAM said that there was a technical problem, but didn't say what the technical problem was. Apparently, the story goes on to say that the instruments went dead for a little bit on this Boeing 787. And originally it said that both Flight Radar 24 and FlightAware didn't show any change of an altitude. Now, that's also changed. Apparently, the aircraft fell off the screens of both FlightAware for about 2 hours into the three-hour flight. And that could have had something to do with a technical problem, too. Maybe ADS-B went out, or it could have been that there was just nobody to pick up the ADS-B while it was over the Tasman Sea. But I think what the story really says is, if you're in an airplane and you're in flight, wear your seatbelt.
Absolutely, we've argued for that perspective before in the past, and it sounds like it was a real mess in there. There's some quotes from some of the passengers. One passenger told the BBC, he said the plane unannounced just dropped. I mean, it dropped unlike anything I've ever experienced on any kind of minor turbulence, and people were thrown out of their seats, hit the top of the roof of the plane, thrown down the aisles. Some of the roof panels were broken from people being thrown up and knocking through the plastic roof panels in the aisleways, and it finishes, and there was blood coming from several people's heads. So, yeah, 13 people you mentioned, Micah, were taken to the hospital, 10 passengers and 3 crew members. Reportedly, one person is in serious condition, but the other people are okay. It is just sort of strange that the airline used the term a technical event. That's their quote, a technical event occurred.
That kind of is what bothered me, too. I mean, a technical event. So it from what I can understand, it wasn't a weather event, as in bad weather or turbulence that they mentioned. A technical event. In order to have the aircraft lose altitude enough to put people on the ceiling, that's a pretty significant nose-over procedure. And I'm just trying to think of what kind of technical event, if it was something wrong with the aircraft, wouldn't also be, I mean, I grant you we're trying to pick this apart, but that it wouldn't also be labeled as a safety event, in the sense that some part of the control system failed or went wacky for 10 seconds. But they didn't mention that either. So a technical event. I don't know, Max, tell me what you think, but I'm thinking the technical event kind of sounds like maybe somebody up front either hit something they weren't supposed to or didn't do something, or maybe an autopilot issue that it's just very strange.
Yeah, I agree. There have been some cases in the past where there's been, something that's happened where the controls get banged or something gets turned off. I mean, these things are extremely rare. And you almost kind of wonder, well, let's see, technical event. Is that really a code for the pilot screwed up? I don't know. This could be just about anything. Pretty hard to know based on this information.
Yeah, we definitely need more information, and I'm sure we'll have it.
No, we don't. We don't need any information. We can just speculate on the few facts that we have, and everybody will believe it, won't they? Oh, wait, the mics are live, aren't they? I'm sorry. We don't actually think like that, guys. I mean, I know.
But LATAM Airlines did say, and sometimes, it's best not to say anything at all, but they said they deeply regretted any inconvenience and discomfort this situation may have caused its passengers. Oh, come on. A prepared statement. I mean, that's a little lax.
What's up with the geeks? There's nothing that's up with the geeks this week. Huh? Nobody's got anything interesting going on. David, you've got some events and things coming to the American Helicopter Museum.
Oh, sure. You would make me call up the calendar, wouldn't you?
Well,
okay. I got it. So, we actually have a book event coming up on the 21st of March. And that is our speaker series. It's Charles Morgan Evans talking about Helicopter Heroine, who one of our Whirly Girls, one of the very first female helicopter pilots, who actually flew in during the Vietnam War, actually the French Vietnam portion of the war, and did rescue airlift. So that's really interesting. Story about a woman helicopter pilot that occurred long before a lot of other women were flying and in combat situations. So that's, again, March 21st at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
All right.
And I am chipmunk free.
You are chipmunk free.
Last week, I don't think it got into the podcast, but a chipmunk got into my house on Monday, and we were watching for it behind me in the camera. But haven't seen it since. We think it went out the second story window, which I'm fine with. I hope it didn't get hurt, but, there's no chipmunk in my house now.
You think the chipmunk leapt out of the second floor window?
The traps haven't been set. The exterminator thinks that's what he did, and I haven't heard it or seen it since. So,
all right.
I think I'm chipmunk.
So they're indicating that the chipmunk was a second story man, huh?
Okay. Absolutely.
Let's wildly speculate what happened to the chipmunk.
I think this is just a cover. This is an explanation for why Mike was a little squirrely last week.
Oh, you mean you're not talking about him being nuts, are you?
All right, a little bit of listener mail. We heard from...
Wait a minute. There's a shout-out that we haven't talked about yet on the air.
I thought we already did that.
I don't think we were recording at the time.
We recorded it.
Yes, we did.
Okay.
We're not going to sing again.
No.
What was the shout-out, guys?
Nothing, Rob. You'll find out when you listen to the episode.
10 years or something.
Yeah. Josh wrote in. Josh is a flight simmer. He's a previous exhibitor at Flight Sim Expo. He also volunteers with their outreach, or at least he is this year. And he wanted to let us know that the FSA's annual in-person flight simulation convention, that being Flight Sim Expo, is on this year, June 21st through 23rd, 2024, at Rio, Las Vegas. Exhibitor applications are open. You have to register before March 2nd. Well, that wouldn't work, would it? It's too late for that.
And who wants to go to Las Vegas anyway?
I've been to Las Vegas about three times. But he says that there are more than 50 exhibitors and sponsors that have been confirmed, and also that attendee registration, compared to last year is more than double for this time of year. So if you're interested in Flight Sim Expo, it's a great event, flightsimexpo.com. Also, we heard from Patrick Wiggins. He sent in a couple of items more from the land of EV aircraft. And the first one this new Airbus Air Taxi has a 50-mile range and is quieter than a hairdryer. Kind of sounded a little bit interesting. I wonder how they measure that. Well, they describe it a little bit. So,
well, is the hairdryer next to your ear, or is it, I know, 50 feet away?
Is it the Air Taxi up in the air, what it sounds like when you're on the ground or right next to it? Well, they do explain it. And, well, this has to do with the City Airbus next-gen prototype. Now, it's a zero-emission eVTOL designed to carry 4 people. And with the decibel rating, it says below 65 A-weighted decibels during flyover and below 70 decibels during landing. And so that's pretty quiet. It's not the quietest thing out there, but it's pretty quiet. And like many of these eVTOLs, it's expected to be piloted at the beginning, at first, and then autonomous later.
Well, they won't be falling asleep, will they?
Oh, they better not, right? That was from electric.co. There's also another article from them. Well, I think it's interesting that Airbus seems to be taking the air taxi, the eVTOL thing pretty seriously. And apparently they're, proceeding with this. I say apparently, I mean, they are proceeding with this. We don't know, I don't think, what the actual long-term commitment is to this idea. But at least for the present time, Airbus, along with many, many other people, are pursuing the eVTOL concept. We know the Chinese have been working on it. XPeng's Aero HT is another eVTOL, and they're developing a couple of craft, the eVTOL, but also a flying car, or maybe a flying car that becomes an eVTOL or something of that sort. But they expect to enter production in 2025. So there's a lot of eVTOL people out there. And I still think there's going to be a lot of likely industry consolidation and maybe, in my personal opinion, maybe a scaling back of expectations for when these things will actually be carrying paying customers.
Oh, how could there not be? I mean, there are hundreds of these things in various stages, and there would be no competition. People would be marketing 2 or 3 units, and then someone else will have 2 or 3 or 5 or 10. But it's going to take a little longer, I think, than people want to admit.
Yeah, I think, Rob, that may be the best way to look at it. We heard from Tom Walker. Now, he's authored a book. It's called The White Bird Story, A Conspiracy of Silence. You can find that on Amazon.com. But I'm not familiar with this history at all. Sounds kind of fascinating. He makes the argument that the French were actually the first to fly across the Atlantic nonstop. They did that in 1927, coming from France to the United States. I don't know where they landed, but it sounds like they crash landed, actually 12 days before Lindbergh flew to Paris. Both the pilots survived the crash, apparently, but he says they were later murdered by local woodsmen, and they buried them in the wilderness along with the plane. This sounds like it landed in Maine or something, Mike. I don't know. But
I swear, I was nowhere
Max,
near
don't
that.
Don't do
area.
That. I find this.
I'm not sure. I don't know. But he says that's why they weren't found. He does say that there was a visible trench made by the plane when it came down, and that actually you can see it in Google Maps. So I haven't heard this story anywhere else. It sounds like something that, you know, if it's all true, has been underreported, I guess.
How about not reported?
Or not reported.
I mean, underreported would mean it was reported a few times. I mean, this is supposed to be 100 years ago, and there's still a trench where the airplane skidded into the woods, visible on Google Maps, 100 years later. Okay, well, it's possible. I'm not saying it's...
When you look up the names, because I just looked up the book on Amazon, and I got the names of the pilots. When you look up the names, and you, at least this is what I'm finding on Wikipedia, it says that let me find it here. He and both pilots took off from Paris on 8 May 1927 and were last seen over Ireland. And then less than 2 weeks later, Lindbergh made the New York to Paris journey. So it's interesting.
Mm.
And it goes on to say that investigators starting in the 1980s suggest that it probably reached Newfoundland and may have crashed in Maine.
I knew there was a Maine connection here. It just sounds like Maine. I'm sorry.
I wasn't even born, I swear.
I know. It wasn't you.
And Stephen King wasn't around either. But it sounds like a book he could write.
It does, doesn't it?
And those woodsmen, they always do it. The woodsmen chop people up.
But it says that the disappearance has an extensive legacy and is referred to in many films and museums, and there's a street in Paris that's named after them.
Huh. Well, this sounds like an interesting project for somebody who's interested in researching old historic events. And
yeah, but the book is there. It's a large print format, and there it is on Amazon, The White Bird Story, A Conspiracy of Silence.
All right. We had another listener write in, and he says he's an avid listener, lives in Texas. His father started flight training and is now working up through the various ratings. And he's interested in becoming part of the aviation community. And he's interested in a roadmap. What's the best way to start flying? And, I mean, that's a pretty broad topic, and I think there's probably a lot of different ways, but I'll defer to the two pilots in the group, and maybe they can provide some thoughts on this.
Well, taking off is a good start if you want to start flying.
See, I was going to say flap your arms, but that would have been rude.
Go ahead, Rob. What are your thoughts?
I think we need to know a little bit more information. I mean, learning to fly is not an inexpensive endeavor. You know, we don't know what kind of resources this person has at his or her disposal. We don't know if this is a man or a woman, do we?
I think we do not know.
And we don't know the age either, which is something that I was thinking about as well.
How does that matter, Rob? Do women learn to fly differently than men?
No, I meant, and I was just saying, I used the word him, and I said, well, but then it could be a her. So just, you know, mind your own business, Max. You know, you get to talk a lot on this show, and I don't get to do hardly anything because nobody listens to me much. Do they, David?
Okay. Bottom line is this. If you want to learn to fly, the easiest thing to do is go to an airport.
Bingo.
Good.
Find somebody there, and it sounds like your father is one of those people who knows people, and go wash an airplane. Go sit at a fence line. Go talk to people. Either way, it's easy. Considering this group of individuals, pilots, are really easy to talk to, and pilots are the first ones to tell you they're pilots. Everybody finds their own way in this industry, you know, and finds their own way to becoming pilots, etc. So there's no right or wrong way to do it, but you got to start somewhere. So what I would suggest you do is go to an airport, take an EAA flight, take
a discovery flight. Ride or, yeah, exactly. That's actually what I was going to say.
And that will, you know, in that point on, you can figure out what you want to do and when you want to do it and how you want to do it and if you can afford and or how you can afford it. So
yeah, I like what you said. There are so many different ways to go about getting a flight certificate to get a license. But one thing you may find is each time you talk to a pilot, they'll tell you that the way they got their license is the best way to go about becoming a pilot. So yeah. Be a little skeptical about that. But yeah, the first thing I would have said, same thing, David, go to the local airport, find a flight school and start talking to flight instructors there. And probably this person may be wondering more generically, well, should I do some self-study first or take a course or do a ground school before I take a flying lesson? The answer is, doesn't matter. I've seen people do the theory all up front, and so they know everything there is possibly to know about flying, and then they take lessons. I've seen the opposite, which is true, where they fly, and then they, you know, toward the end do more of the study. So all kinds of ways to do it.
And the other thing that I was going to say is that, you know, the reason that I asked the age, if this is a, you know, an adult with a job already and all that, I think going to the airport is the absolute best thing to do right away and to start, you know, doing that, figuring out what it's going to cost and if you can afford it. If it happens to be a young person, then I think it's important and what you want to do with it. The one way to go is to some of the universities that offer flight schools, whether it's a 2-year degree or a 4-year degree. It's important to have a degree as well as your license in a lot of cases. Some airlines won't even interview you without a degree if that's what you want to do long term. And then the military is also a good route, although not a guarantee that you'll learn to fly necessarily. But there's a lot of different ways to do it.
Rob, did you learn to fly in the Air Force or did you fly before then?
No, I learned to fly down at University of Illinois in Champaign. That's where I started learning to fly, actually, but I didn't finish. And so I quit college after one semester because I knew it wasn't for me. And I joined the Air Force the next year, and off I went. I started learning to fly again in the Aero Club at one of the Air Force bases. And that's kind of where I got back into it. But again, and that was my story. It'd be great if you can get through the Air Force training or the Navy training. It's very rigorous. And of course, you'll have a commitment. I believe it's 10 years now, if they teach you to fly, that you have to remain on active duty. So You know, there's a cost to it, even though you don't pay for it in hard dollars out of your pocket. You know, and then of course you have to qualify if you do become to even try to become a military pilot. But again, there are so many ways to do it, as we've said. I wish this listener could give us just a little more information about what he's thinking about, other than learning to fly. It's like learning to swim. Yeah, you dive in the water. I mean, well, okay. I mean, but when we get serious, I mean, there's just so much information out there that it's hard to come up with a definitive answer.
Max T, when did you start flying?
Oh, I started taking lessons when I was 15. And so my mom used to have to drive me to the airport because I did not have a driver's license. And so I would then go off and fly the airplane.
Did you jump right into flying lessons or did you take a discovery flight or how did that come about?
Yeah, so the structure that I had was that there was just one flight instructor at the airport. That made it pretty easy. He was the guy that did everything, ran the airport and mowed the grass and did charter flights if somebody needed a charter flight. He was also a flight instructor. But the very first lesson that I did was half an hour long, and it turns out that was pretty much what he did. I've looked at my logbook and virtually every, of the first 10 lessons, virtually each of them was a half hour long. We sat in the airplane, which was a 1967 Cessna 150. And we talked for a few minutes and started the airplane. And he said, okay, now you take off, which shocked me. I was just stunned. It was like, wait a minute. What do you mean I take off? I know nothing about airplanes. I was really kind of flummoxed that he would say that. But he kind of guided me through it. And that's when I kind of realized, I guess, taking off must be the easy part about flying if they let you do that on your first lesson. Now, when I'm teaching folks, yeah, I'm giving them a lot of help, but I'm not usually having them take off on the first lesson. But that's what it was like.
Wow. And I would, I think we had somebody from the Aviation Careers podcast on the show a couple of times, which is a great podcast and still going strong. This is what our listener is looking for, is a career in aviation, that might not be a bad podcast to listen to and get in touch with as well. They might be able to offer some more information, more than we might be able to.
That was probably Carl Villari.
Yep.
Yes. Yep. Yep. Aviation Careers podcast, a great podcast. Carl's a great guy. If you've ever met Carl, I know some of you have anyway.
Yeah.
Yep. Down at Sun and Fun or other places.
And he also publishes a guide to aviation scholarships. It used to be a book. Now I think it's online. You pay a small amount of money for access to it. And so if anybody is looking to learn to fly, if you don't have the money to learn to fly, this is probably a good investment, is to pay the few bucks to get access to literally hundreds of scholarships that are available around the country. And somebody has to get that money, and you might be one of those people. So it really pays to go ahead and apply for every scholarship for which you think you qualify.
Yes. All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap up this episode. A little shorter than usual. We didn't have a guest this episode. We do have one scheduled for next week, however, so we'll be back to our usual format. But we want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. And this being episode 790, you can go directly to the show notes by visiting airplanegeeks.com/790. Our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We also have a Slack listener team. We have a little Discord server. If you write us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, we'll tell you how to get in and join the crew. All right. Max Trescott, anything closing?
Oh, sure. I just want to mention that this past week on the Aviation News Talk podcast, I reviewed recent fuel exhaustion and fuel starvation accidents. And this is how I came upon that. I decided to go back and look at all of the NTSB reports that have been published for the past 6 weeks. And as I went through them, I was just stunned that there were 10 of these accidents where, in most cases, people ran out of fuel. In some cases, they had the fuel tank switched to the wrong, you know, place. So just really fascinating the number of ways that people can encounter what should be a fairly easy accident to avoid. So check that out at aviationnewstalk.com. And, of course, if you want to reach me, just go to aviationnewstalk.com and click contact at the top of the page.
And, Max, that's another reason why I hate daylight savings time. Fuel exhaustion. Everybody's exhausted from
everybody's
it.
Everybody's tired. All right. David Vanderhoof.
Boom, boom.
Yeah, I know. Anything closing?
You can find me at the American Helicopter Museum, and that's helicoptermuseum.org is the website. Check out all of the stuff, and you can reach me there if you'd like.
You know, we waved at you a few days ago, David, as we drove by. We just didn't have time to stop at the museum and see you. I was really disappointed because I really wanted to surprise. You know, I never show up announced, right? It's always unannounced.
Yeah, well, no, yeah. You just sort of walk in the door and I'm like, who are you? Oh.
It's kind of fun. All right. Rob Mark, anything from you?
No, the standard disclaimer that I hang out at anything with jetwine.com in the name of it and between the pages of a number of magazines, unless, of course, you don't like what I wrote, and then it was because Max Trescott put me up to it.
What?
You got his attention there. All right. And how about you, Micah?
Well, I'm still on Twitter. I may be the last one, but I'm there, and it's at Maine Fly, Maine like the state of Maine, Fly. And then you can find me with Pasadena Brian Coleman, our former associate producer on the Journey is Reward podcast. We recorded a couple episodes last week, and one of them should be out on Monday the 18th, and that should be with Matt Smith from the PTUK podcast, the only aviation podcaster that I know that doesn't like to fly and is afraid of flying. And that's what we talk about with
Matt's a great, he's a great guy.
I like he's him. A terrific guy. Yeah, and it was a good interview. It was a lot of fun talking with him.
I haven't seen him in a couple of years.
Yeah.
All right. That's something we should do. Maybe we should, I don't know. We should do some kind of a tour, you know, or I don't know. It's got to be more traveling involved and seeing people that we know and love.
Well, they're going to be coming up on their 500th episode soon, Plain Talking UK. So for 400, Brian and I went, and I'm hoping that we'll go for 500 as well. And maybe you should come this time, Max.
Maybe I should. I think that's a great idea.
But you can't drive
there. I knew you were going to say that.
Just thought I'd mention it, but, you know. And the taxes going to England are, well.
They're going actually, up, right?
Not taxes, Rob. Yes. They're in the UK. They're not in taxes.
That's right.
All right. I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Mastodon. You can also find me at my website, 30,000feet.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
See you real soon.
Nighty night.
Thanks for listening.
All right. Well, we have a lot of news to get to this episode, so let's jump right in. Is everybody ready?
Ready from the West.
Mainly ready.
Ready from Delaware.
Ready from the middle of the country.
Why do we do this every week?
I have no idea. I have no idea. That's probably what listeners are asking.
They probably are. The first item.
Maybe we should just exit. Oh, I'm sorry.
That might be a good suggestion.
Have we started the celebration yet?
The celebration.
Yeah, it's Rob's birthday.
Ready, guys? It's tomorrow. Oh.
We're not recording yet.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. You know, it's kind of funny. We now know the technology has caught up to happy birthday. Because remember when we used to do it on Skype?
Yes.
And we sang it, and it would be like, happy birthday to you. happy birthday.
So thank you very much. Okay, let's move on.
All right.
I like that.
Yeah, I do too. That's good.
Wow. It's all about sincerity.
Let me see. That.
So Rob's our guest tonight, right?
Rob's our guest.
Actually, no, I'm not. Max Truscott, this is your life.
We could do a great interview with Rob, actually.
Back in the last century.
If you could only remember.
but I don't think people really want to hear about stink bugs, so.
No, I think that's probably true. We've been invaded with them this winter. They didn't die off.
I mean, God knows we've talked enough about cicadas. People are going to think this is the entomology channel or something like that.
I have these ladybug things, except that...
There we go. See, what did I say?
Yeah, but I'm told they look exactly like ladybugs to me, but I'm told they're not actually ladybugs. They're some kind of a different invasive species or something.
I've heard about that. They look like ladybugs, but it's a different beetle.
Well, they're slut bugs. That's what they are, right?
Yeah.
They're not ladies.
So I have my trusty hand vacuum cleaner strategically located next to the bed so I can suck them up when they appear.
Do they climb on you in bed?
Well, one did yesterday, but last night. But normally they are on the windows. They seem, you know, attracted to either the light or the warmth of the sun coming through the window. I'm not sure.
But, all right, guys. So there's competition out there already. There's a page here on 10 best entomology podcasts. So we're behind the eight ball. There's Spectacular Vernacular. There's Entomology, The Endless Knot. Anyway.
Spectacular Vernacular. I like that.
That's cute. There's no entomology geeks, though, huh?
Talk the Talk Entomology from Perth, Australia.
Wow.
I don't think we want to go there.
No.
The
space is crowded.
Or April Fool's episode?
Yeah. The people that don't know the difference between entomology and entomology really bug me. I don't have the words to express it. I think I sent that to you guys.
You did. It's hysterical.
I feel the same way.
You feel hysterical?
No, I'm historical.
That's what I say.